I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord and these are the Legacy Tapes. I'm here still at the Slunglow Hub in Leeds with the rather awesome Matt Berman, who I described you as badass this morning. The badass Matt Berman, is the artistic director of Yorkshire Festival and was previously at Warwick Arts Centre, and is sort of cutting a sway through the contemporary theatre scene.
Something like that.
Something like that. Is that one all right?
I was trying to think of the line from Going on a Bear Hunt. It feels more sort of swishy swashy than cutting a swathe.
Okay, so he's swishy swashying through the contemporary theatre scene. And I thought, Matt, that you would be a good person to talk to because you left somewhere and started somewhere new. And I, in my experience, that's when you're most likely to think about, you kind of sum things up or you make plans for the future. And this idea about legacy and like, and what you might want to
Absolutely. Yeah, I suppose, I mean, as well as moving from Warwick recently, I've moved around quite a bit, really. So I was at Norfolk and Norwich Festival before that and at Forced Entertainment before that. So it's been a series of jumps and shifts over the last few years. And all of this, you know, when we're thinking about theatre, you know, this was from a background of not really theatre. You know, I trained as a musician, and I grew up in the theatre. My parents were theatre designers, so you know, I've kind of been, thinking about legacy is a very interesting one actually, because I think, you know, I often thought about the Buddhist thing of just passing through, you know, as a personal philosophy, I suppose, you know, the Jack Kerouac on the road sort of thing. Which basically means not having an impact and not leaving legacy, just sort of as cutting sway. It's quite nice actually, because you just pass through and tread lightly. But I suppose I have started to think more about legacy, but in little ways, I suppose, is it, you know, ensuring organisations in some respects are changed and developed and improved. Improved's not always the right word, but are changed in some way, transformed in some way. Or are in a better position than when I started there, I suppose, or a different position. I suppose I haven't, you know, it's interesting. Starting at the Yorkshire Festival has been a very different start to other starts at organisations, because, you know, coming into somewhere like Norfolk and Norwich Festival, which had been going for something like 230 years, or Forced Entertainment, who had been going for 20 years. And Warwick Arts Centre had been going for nearly 40 years. And then Yorkshire Festival, which is only in its second edition. So it's sort of like I'm jumping from three organisations that have already got a legacy, I suppose, to looking at how you establish a legacy from day one, or you establish the potential for legacy from day one.
So what did you, when you arrived, what did you want? What were you thinking? This is what I want it to become.
Well, I inherited a really strong terms of reference from our steering group, which was to establish Yorkshire Festival as a significant national and international multi-art form festival, presented on a biennial basis. So the last one was in 2014, and it was this mammoth 100-day cultural programme leading up to the Grand Départ Tour de France in Yorkshire, and then developing that as a sort of a standalone event, so not directly, we don't have to make everything bike-themed now, which would have been traumatic if we had to do that for any length of time. I've got nothing against bikes, they're great.
Bizarrely, I can think of at least three pieces that people are making right now about bikes.
It's relatively easy, actually, if you think about things that people like Blaster who made Rider Spoke and things like that. You know, there are plenty of things. But anyway, it would have been quite a tight frame to operate in.
Yes.
And, you know, starting work, returning back to Leeds, because I grew up here, starting work in Leeds again and relearning the city, and starting at a time when the thinking about 2023, Leeds going for European Capital of Culture in 2023, have really started to gain momentum, and there's a really interesting group of people thinking about those plans. So first time I've actually started an organisation and thought, okay, well, there's kind of a 10-year plan in the back of my mind, yeah, about how Yorkshire Festival can really support and contribute to that process towards that securing that accolade, yeah, or poison chalice, whichever way you look at it. And I think, yeah, so that's in the back of my mind. But I think that's about a trajectory more than a legacy, I suppose, legacy is quite hard to think about
before it happens. Without
looking backwards. I mean, yeah. I think one phrase, I suppose, or one sort of thought experiment, something like that, that is relevant, though, is that I think a lot about the word entertainment, because it has become an undervalued phrase, particularly in relation to contemporary work. I suppose not that people aren't making entertaining work, but it's not necessarily they don't think, right, I'm going to make something entertaining. And I look at the word in a slightly different way. Obviously, entertainment, the derivation of the word is from the Latin, I think, to hold within, which, you know, in the simplest terms, was about something that happened indoors. Mm. You know, it was a thing indoors. Mm. But I've sort of extended that to mean something that people hold within them. So it's the act of entertainment is communicating something in some way that the audience or the viewer connects and takes something from that experience and carries that with them wherever they go. And that is, again, about, you know, transformation and the transformative power of things. And I think that's legacy. You know, I do want to communicate or produce or deliver or create experiences or collaborate with artists to create experiences that change the world. You know, well, don't start small, you know, think big.
Tell me what you want to change about the world.
Oh God, what don't I want to change about the world? I mean, I think it's a political act. Art is a political act, or it has the power to be a political act at the moment. I think there's so much that needs addressing in terms of equality and equity and social justice and our ability to communicate between cultures, between communities, between countries, that can be achieved through the arts, you know, through any artistic act. And yeah, again, coming from Warwick, where Warwick Arts Centre is in the centre of the campus of the University of Warwick, if you don't know that, surrounded by these great thinkers and people generating ideas that no doubt will have significant impacts on our future lives, you know, whether it's sociological or economic or medical or physical, but I mean in terms of physics, astrophysical, and our understanding of who we are and our position in the universe and all of that. But I've been thinking for a long time that it's in the coming together of artists and academics that actually we have the most potential to change the world, because you have the great idea that's going to influence our future existence, you have the means of communicating that idea. But it's not simply about, you know, I know the fad for people to go, I'm not sure what I'm going to make next. I'll go and talk to an academic and find a really great academic idea, and then I'll make a show about that.
Yeah.
And it's not about the opposite, which is when you get an academic department going, I want to communicate my research about mortality and dying. I'll get a puppet company, or you get a choreographer who says, I want to make a piece about the mind, find me a neuroscientist. I think those can create really interesting work. I'm not denigrating that in any way, but I think
it's just more complex than
It's more complex. And also I think it's about, and you know, this is not something that we achieved at Warwick necessarily, but it's about artists and academics, or an artist and an academic coming together, finding a shared area of concern, and then travelling together in the research and expression of that research. Mm. And I think that's because I'm most interested in artists who are compelled to tell a story. You're compelled in some way to express something that could not be expressed in any means other than through their practice.
Yeah.
And it's that compulsion that I find most exciting. You know, that's where the passion lies. That's where you have the most potential for that meeting of art and audience and the spark and the heat and the dynamic.
And the thing that is more than the sum of its parts.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, thinking about, like, it feels quite grandiose thinking about that.
I'm going to keep coming back to this. Go on, like, challenge the by all means, reject the premise of the question.
I think, for me, it's much lighter than that. You know, I see my work as a programmer, a producer, a curator, you know, a commissioner, whatever. Mm. It's about stewardship, I think, to a large degree. It's about ensuring that I conscientiously commit to ensuring the supply of the resources needed to artists to create the work that will have that impact and develop that audience. You know, there is a curatorial act in that, but the most important thing is that I touch those resources as lightly as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, that and that I've always wanted to commit early. You know, I love a long conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and some people listening to this will be saying, you never commit. We've been talking for years and you've still not done anything with me. But I think at times it's about really connecting with an idea really early on and just saying, yes, let's do that.
Mm.
That was brilliant, crazy, beautiful.
Yeah. Because then you're the fertiliser that lets it grow, mm. right? You become almost the maker of it.
Yeah. You know, and I've talked before, you know, when I was at Norfolk and Norwich, you know, we were talking as a sort of management team, you know, producers and development and all of that lot, marketing, all of that lot, all the important people, not the artists, about, you know, how we create an irrigation system, actually. Mm. You know, we want to create the most efficient, effective irrigation system whereby the artistic idea can flow most effectively to the audience.
Mm.
And I think the legacy can be in creating those structures so that those structures work really well.
Yeah.
And the legacy is obviously in creating sustainable practice for artists, you know, allowing artists to actually have careers, paying them properly to do the job that they want, need to do, and we want and need them to do as well. You know, we can't exist without
and that allow them to live as human beings within our society.
Yeah, human beings, and about, you know, I know there are lots of us and them dynamics in the world in which we work, but the fewer of those we can have, the better. You know,
I feel slightly bad that I chanted on Facebook about just for the benefit of the podcast. I posted on Facebook grumbling about producers getting all the artistic director jobs and worrying about it. And Matt Bourbon said, "I worry about myself." So that's the elephant in the room there.
It's not an elephant. I mean, I totally agree with the idea that you're expressing, that too often artistic organisations, theatres, art centres are becoming led by an executive rather than an artistic lead.
And probably just, I think it's also about the politics of it. It's something that Alan was saying in the other podcast that they did at the Sluglow Hub about... you know, it's the economic factors that are the driving force, and that this place exists to make money rather than to make art.
Yeah,
and I think that's what I worry about.
Yeah, no, I think that. Well, and you can see that all over the country. You know, I had that challenge when I started here in Yorkshire. That, you know, I started in October for a festival in June, which is crazy. And so quickly phoning around theatres to see whether there was any space available for me to actually programme any work into there.
Yeah.
And 90% of them were fully programmed, which, you know, is fine. But then, you know, particularly some of the bigger houses, some of the number one venues were just full of the most awful... No, I should, maybe I should self-censor that. Full of commercial products.
You were going to say awful dross, weren't you?
Yes, I was going to say that. But that's a value judgment which I should maybe not apply in this situation. But, you know, full of commercial products.
Yeah.
Which is very successful. And obviously probably 90% of audiences in those venues are going once a year, and they're very happy to go and see that work. And, you know, I'm not in any way... downplaying or undervaluing the value of those experiences for those people in those situations. It's very frustrating if you're a programmer looking for a nice big theatre to put some nice international work into that you've got back-to-back musicals to contest with not a Rizzler between them. I think if you look at programming internationally, you look at programming in comparable size cities across the rest of Europe, there is much more of a sense of challenge. And because they've been on that journey for a lot longer, it's no longer a challenge in terms of audiences, because the audiences want that challenge.
Yeah, you know?
The wonderful Jamie Wood, who we both know and love, was, I think this is his anecdote, he was in Spain, I think, talking to a Belgian or a Dutch programmer who was saying it's now kind of subversive to do the well-made play in the Low Countries, because, you know, nobody's making the well-made play over there. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's our challenge, I think, in this country. If there were a legacy that I'd like to secure, it's that we kind of break the cycle of risk aversion, where, you know, we have programmers who perceive audiences to be risk averse, so therefore program risk averse work, which encourages artists to create more risk averse work, which only develops a risk averse audience, and we're just spiralling down and down and down.
Because I don't think audiences are risk averse.
No, I don't. I think we've forgotten the intelligence of our audiences, or we've sidelined that intelligence in favour of sometimes shonky audience intelligence that we're getting from postcodes and from other systems, which are not really qualitative, if you're going to use an evaluative.
The joy of quantity, not quality.
God, I hate those phrases. But, you know, sometimes the data you get from them, sometimes the information, the intelligence you get from those things are really useful, but sometimes they can contribute to people making decisions which aren't based on risk, on challenge, on intelligence, on an artistic passion. You know, I think the thing that is most obvious to an audience is when something is being programmed without any
care.
Commitment or care, or, you know, and or a programmer actually thinking, I really fucking love this piece of work, I'm going to program it whether anybody likes it or not, in a way. And sometimes it's that, you know, it can be slightly dictatorial, egotistic,
but why the fuck not, I say.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you look across Europe, the really great programs, or the programs that I am most excited by are those that are led by really singular visions, or, you know, inclusive visions, but, you know, visions that are based on passion, passion and intelligence, I suppose. And I think, legacy, I'd love that to happen. I'd love us to break out that cycle, I think. And that's a cultural condition that we've been in this country for 70, 80 years, longer, probably.
It's supposed to be. So someone was talking to me about political theory the other day and saying that ideological chunks go in roughly 72-year cycles. So any time now, it's all to play for.
Mm.
And it could be something we could make the world anew.
72 years. So 72 years from 45, that would be what? My math is rubbish. 22, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. So we've got like...
No,
27. So we've got 11 years.
Yeah, but unfortunately, if you think that the shift after the Second World War was towards something much more left-wing, and particularly in this country, much more focused on a welfare state, that implies...
Yeah, but then we... But then you could also... this isn't a conversation for this podcast.
we want a different legacy.
About where we date our change from.
Yeah.
What am I going to say? Yeah, I feel like that risk, that sense of risk aversion, it just essentially forgets the fundamental nature of humanity, which is that we're all bloody curious.
Yeah.
Like, we kind of can't help it. Even the dullest, most disinterested, apathetic people will cross the street to see what's making that noise.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think one thing that I think the media and our education system has taken this away, it's taken away a confidence in people to respond to work authentically or in the way which they naturally would respond to that work, but people are told that either work isn't for them, you know, the whole thing around elitist art forms in this country, which is deeply frustrating to me as somebody who... I suppose across the divide from classical to contemporary, if you like.
Yeah.
But I think, people are told, you know, the classic sort of Daily Mail purient headline around Arts Council money wasted on filth, you know, whatever the headline.
The idea that most people don't like filth.
Yeah.
That's basically what I think about.
Pretty dirty.
It's like it's food. It's filth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah, we should make that show.
I'm so fucking... I'm in. The Yorkshire Festival 2018, that's it.
Yorkshire Festival funds food and filth. That's a great headline. But I think, we need to find ways of giving confidence back to our audiences. You know, we're doing a project as part of Yorkshire Festival this year called Creative Critics, which we're... presenting, delivering in collaboration with Company of Angels and Christina Burt Projects, which will be working with two classes of 10-year-olds in schools in Huddersfield and Merfield, they have three workshops before the festival, which are on, you know, critical theoretical concepts like what is art, how do you view art, how do we use art, that sort of thing. And then they'll see three shows during the festival to which they'll write critical responses, which we'll then publish with the Yorkshire Post. But they're not the shows that you would necessarily take a group of 10-year-olds to. They're selected by the 10-year-olds and their teachers, so we're not foisting them on them. We're not saying, you must go and see this. But they're going to go and see Melanie Wilson's opera for An Unknown Woman. They'll see Selena Thompson's Salt. They're going to go and see a new visual arts piece by Imran Qureshi. What else are they seeing? They're going to the Nile Project, which is a big collaboration between musicians from the Nile Delta. And then they'll write about those experiences. And I'd actually love to do that with, you know, groups of people across the whole of the county, intergenerational groups from, you know, all sorts of demographics. Because I think actually that experience is not one that's been given to people over the last 20, 30 years. Yeah. As cultural education in this country has been gradually eroded or stripped to the bone, definitely. And I think there are fascinating debates, as we know, between various friends of ours who are critics and writers online about, you know, about criticism in this country. And I think, you know, there are some brilliant new developments in that, and clearly online and blogging and other forms of media than the mainstream press is really broadening that. And I think if we can encourage more people to see more work and just say what they think about it, because I think that's the thing that, you know, in this country, yes, with our, if you like, core audiences, they will stick around afterwards and they'll go to the Q&A and they'll sit around at the bar and talk about it after the show. But I think too often, because theatre is your good night out, to use an Arts Council demographic.
Yeah.
Big night out.
Is it dinner and a show?
Dinner and a show. That's the one.
Urbanised eclectic. Culture vultures and your dinner and a show.
Traditional culture vulture.
Yeah.
Those are the old categories, though, aren't they, anyway?
I think I'm shit, I'm out of date.
Yeah, I'm out of date. But I think, it's about something that's, you know, is not deeply thought-provoking for those people, or even if it is, they don't want to think about it too much. They might say, oh, that was nice.
Right. So look, because that isn't just about how we think about art. That's about how we think about our place in the world and the world.
Yeah.
This idea that thinking isn't something one does for pleasure, or having, or that difficult things are unpleasant. Like complexity is unpleasant.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's something that's embedded in every aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Of everything that we do. So that's in our education system, it's in our economic system, it's in how we're... it's in everything. I'm just sharing that possibility.
That's a statement, not a question.
There isn't a point, really.
No, I think that's true. I think if we could engender that desire to embrace uncertainty far more, you know, this, you know, something that I love saying to people, you know, just... I don't know what it means still, really, but you know, you want people... Chris Thorpe has a line, I can't remember from which piece, you know, the certainty of the fascist, you know, you want the opposite, you want the sort of fluidity, the mutability, the sense of conversation, of dialogue that comes from uncertainty, actually. And we want to be able to have really passionate discussions which are not personalised, you know, that we're talking about, you know, there are so many things in society that we should be having, you know, Tassos Stevens talks about the good question, you know, getting to the point where you can have a conversation with somebody who might have a very differing political
and really
view
have a conversation and really like listen and potentially leave changed.
Yeah.
Like leave yourself vulnerable to being wrong.
Yeah. And I think, again, theatre allows that possibility, you know, although do we explore that as often as we could? You know, again, Chris Thorpe's confirmation gave access to thinking that was very different to how the left liberal might view the world, obviously. But how often do we actually hear those viewpoints on stage, actually? Very rarely.
Oh, yeah.
And if we don't think about them, and we don't allow ourselves those conversations, I think, or that even the thought experiment, actually, then when we encounter those things in the real world, we aren't necessarily equipped to discuss them or to debate those things, potentially. I don't know. But I think
I've just listened to a This American Life podcast, actually, called For Your Reconsideration, should you wish to source it. And one of the stories in it is talking about a piece of research that they reported on a year ago about how essentially if you send political canvassers out doorstepping to have a genuine conversation with people around issues, and they're using, you know, red flag issues like abortion and trans identity, and, you know, in the American Midwest, if you can have a genuine conversation and give the person you're talking to space to think through the issues, in the course of 20 minutes, you can change someone's mind and how they will vote politically.
Mm-hmm.
And that change will stay. I mean, they've only measured 6 months into the future now, but that change appears to endure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was originally, it's a study originally published in Science magazine that was discredited because someone had messed with the data that they then redid, and it proved to be even truer. So thank God. Mm. And it feels like that's what theatre and the arts can do, right? Mm. It gives people that space to have a dialogue and come to new conclusions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, in terms of stewardship, it's for those people with that opportunity and that privilege to both present work and develop an audience for that work, to ensure that we're bringing as diverse a range of opinions and views into the room to view that work as it is to present a diversity of views or diversity of people on that stage as well. I think, and lots of people are doing that all the time. You know, I think the potential at the moment in this country still is much higher than it has been for a long time. And I think maybe it sounds like I'm very negative in terms of that risk aversion. And I think I'm probably talking about much larger organisations rather than, you know, the work that Alan and Paul are doing here at Hub, or Live Art Bistro over the other side of town in Leeds, doing Transform Festival, Amy Letman's festival here. And that's just in Leeds. Mm. You know, people like Ian Bloomfield as well, who I think you may have interviewed.
I may have chatted to.
May have had a chat with him. You know, and I think that is because there is a politics, even if it's with a small p, and sometimes it's with a very large p as well, that is in people's minds, even if it's not made explicit through a programme. I think that's something that I try to be really strong on, is not to have themes. I don't like themes in terms of a programme. You know, sometimes you create a frame or a constraint in order to make your life a bit easier.
Market it. Yeah.
You know, we did a really nice season. I use the word nice too often. I liked it. at the season of work at Warwick called Lane, with the L in brackets. Which is a season of one-person shows. And, you know, doing things like that are quite fun because you can play with form in that way. But actually, I find, you know, if you're conscious and you're thinking, then you are or should be responding to a zeitgeist or a sort of political, cultural, social context in which you're operating. You're not in some kind of creative vacuum as a programmer. You are connected with the world and reading papers and
hopefully
and all that kind of thing. And I think rather than present an explicit theme to an audience, it's really exciting to allow them to find their own journeys and their own meaning. Like with any work of art, you know, I don't like works of art which tell me what it means. I want to define that meaning myself.
And
it's most exciting when you've got 100 people in a room and there are 100 different meanings for the thing they've just experienced.
And also with a single curator, or even more than one, like there will be that unconscious theme, you know, because it's what's in this person's, because all of this stuff comes through the filter of this person's brain, whatever their concerns and stresses and worries and fetishes are, they're going to make their way into the stuff.
Yeah, and I hope that because there is a much stronger sense of collaboration across the country at the moment. I feel that, you know, there are so many really exciting conversations happening between various people, producers, programmers, artists, that there is a connectedness that perhaps hasn't always been the case.
Yes.
And, you know, with a lot of thought going on as well at the moment, I know about, you know, the flow of work from the UK internationally and vice versa, the flow of international work to the UK, that I think the greater that connectedness, the greater the geographical spread of those conversations, the more we can affect change. You know, the 20-minute doorstep conversation is probably actually a 20-year conversation in the theatre in a way.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, again, coming back to the legacy question, I think if we can, as a sector, as a group of people, I'm not talking about individual legacy, personal legacy here. I think as a sector, if we can really foster and enhance and enlarge those conversations from this country to other countries and between communities and cultures in this country as well, where there are, you know, psychogeographical boundaries as wide as the channel,
that,
you know, through those conversations and through continuing to develop audiences and continuing to look at where there are barriers and reducing those barriers and where we need to take steps towards people to gain their trust to do that, where actually sometimes taking a step back and allowing them to come to us is also, I think, there's a quality in that as well. but I think just not stopping trying as well, actually. I think provided we all continue to have the conversations, provided we don't get distracted by the conversation as well, because the liberal left is very inclined to tie itself up in knots around words and meaning and signs and signifiers and all the rest.
Let's just worry about intention and get the fuck on with it.
Yeah, exactly. But I again, coming back to it, I think provided we're ensuring the resources are available to artists, so, and that's time, space, money, people where they need people, not people where they don't need people, you know, in terms of some organisations foisting outside eyes on projects or whatever. That I think we, we have the best chance of achieving that, you know, is about, giving agency to artists where they feel they haven't had agency, and giving agency to audiences as well. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a very interesting conversation. You know,
yeah, talk to me about that.
Could you explore this? I think
how do we in this, because how many things are constructed right now, there isn't a lot of structure, there aren't a lot of structures that facilitate giving an audience agency. They are to sit there quietly and be performed at. What would that look like?
What would that look like? I don't know. And in terms of uncertainty, embracing uncertainty. I'm often, I being a Libra, I swing both ways on the question of that agency.
Making none of the jokes.
Making none of the jokes. I always loved Amit Lahav from Gecko's comment about the audience being the last performer in any of his pieces. And obviously the way Gecko and Amit make work, that development continues often through at least one touring period before, well, I don't know whether anything is ever completely fixed with Gecko, but I love that idea of the agency that the audience has in completing a piece of work, even with an end on audience in the dark piece. I love immersive and participatory work. You know, I think, I've really appreciated Coney's work over the years, and, you know, even small, relatively small sort of participatory moments, again, in something like Confirmation, I think can be really strong. And, you know, and the sort of the participatory work that Alan does here with Slung Low and the large scale work they've done, I find fascinating and, you know, a brilliant development of the form and structure. I also don't think there's anything wrong with the audience sitting in the dark and watching a piece of work, as long as they're acknowledged in the space. I think that acknowledgement by the artist of the audience is really important.
Yeah, reciprocity.
And I do still struggle with plays where people stand on stage and point out into the audience and say, "Look at the mountains."
And rider.
Not mountains, it's an audience. but that's my lack of ability to suspend my disbelief, I think, in lots of ways. But I think it's also about just how we have those conversations. And I think, again, that's about confidence, because, it was an offer that I often made to students at Warwick. And I've always, whenever I've met audiences or, you know, talk with audiences, I've always said, come and tell us what you think of the work. You know, challenge us. I've said directly to groups of students, I want you to be our most challenging friends and audiences. But I think, I don't know whether that always works. I think sometimes if I said, don't, whatever you do, talk to me, they would be more likely to talk to me. If you give people that license, they go, well, it's fine. Yeah. It's about entitlement sometimes, I think. If you take that entitlement away, they're much more likely to want it. I don't know what I mean by that.
It kind of gives it, like, the forbidden is always more valuable, right?
Well, I think, you know, to come back to the elitist thing, and if we can, if I had a legacy, I'd love it to be that people didn't see forms like opera and ballet as elitist anymore, because, you know, obviously ticket prices are ridiculously high in some places, and, you know, they're often very cheap tickets.
But... And also a lot of, you know, because I work a fair bit in opera, I haven't for a while, but I used to, and there is a subsection of the opera audience that doesn't want everybody to come to the opera.
No.
Because they want, you know, they want to put their frock on.
Yeah.
And they want to feel a bit posh.
Yeah. I mean, and that's fine as well. Is that fine? No, I think I have a big problem with audiences who exclude new attenders. Because, you know, I've seen that with those
audiences. A lot of theatre audiences do that.
Like, and classical music audiences and all the rest, you know, the turning around and shushing of people who might not understand
that you don't clap between movies.
Yeah, the etiquette of whatever etiquette. But I think, you know, where, you know, in Eastern Europe, for instance, where within a couple of generations people have fought revolutions to gain access to that culture, you do have a much higher participation or a higher... a larger number of younger audiences going to see that art form and not seeing it as exclusive or elitist. And I think that's because they had to fight for that entitlement, whereas that entitlement, in a way, has always been there, even if audiences can sometimes, audiences can sometimes turn their nose up at new attenders and those buildings aren't necessarily the most welcoming of buildings and et cetera, et cetera.
But also there's something about the kind of the wider macro attitude to class identity, everything. Right now, everything for me is about class identity, because thinking about, you know, my dad's from Hull Site near Burnley, and my aunt, his sister was an opera singer in the village, in like the village amateur opera company that was better than most of the shit I see, know now, and there was a real culture of artistic endeavour across the entire spectrum of this broadly incredibly poor, very working class place. And now those people's equivalents would not have access to that.
No, I don't think they would. And I think that's partly due to the ways in which people consume culture now. You know, how long ago would that be, in the 60s?
40s, 50s.
Yeah. So people weren't regularly sitting down to watch 4 hours of television of an evening. And they
Game of Thrones. Why would you watch opera when there's Game of Thrones?
Well, Game of Thrones might not, couldn't have existed without the ring cycle, maybe. That's a big statement.
I feel like that's a PhD thesis. Yeah. Wagnerian influences in George R. R. Martin's work.
I'm not going to try and reference that one again. But I think, you know, it is about that consumption of culture, or what people deem to be culture. No, it is culture. I'm not going to say that again.
It is culture. Mozart was popular culture.
Exactly. There's this whole thing in this country around doers, not viewers. So you have large numbers of people participating in all sorts of cultural activity, whether it's dancing or singing or, you know, singing in a choir or in playing in amateur orchestras or doing dance concerts or whatever. They're actually the hardest people to get to see a concert, a piece of theatre or a dance show, whatever, because either they're spending all their time doing it anyway, as a, you know, proficient, semi-professional amateurs, enthusiastic amateurs, or, you know, as, you know, as we were saying, they're consuming their culture in different ways. And I think that makes it very hard when people feel they have very rich cultural lives to encourage them to engage with even more culture. You know, you've got really rich cultural lives, but we've got some culture you haven't even seen yet, you know. And I think that when when all our lives are so full, and they're so full of information and families and friends and communication and all of that, that how we, you know, I've talked about how you create those focused, quiet spaces of solace almost in theatres where you can have that shared experience that you can't have elsewhere, but you can have that time to think that you don't have elsewhere, where there's no option to click on another tab or to click a hyperlink or to scroll down.
You have to sit with it.
You have to sit with it. And allow ourselves the time to have those conversations, to have really difficult conversations. We're making a co-commissioned Selena Thompson's Salt with Mayfest in Bristol. And, you know, Selena wants to encourage those awkward conversations around race and ethnicity and slavery and colonialism. And
because until you have them,
and
because you can't move on.
You can't move on, exactly. And, you know, Pauline Mayers, I don't know whether you've come across Pauline's work. It's a new show called What If I Told You, which again is exploring issues around difference and ethnicity and race and
invisibility,
exactly. And, you know, it was fascinating. I went to see work in progress of that show on Saturday at Seven Arts, and the show lasts for about 55 minutes. The Q&A lasted for nearly 2.5 hours.
That's awesome.
Yeah, fascinating. You know, there were 70 people in the show and about 40 people in the post-show as well. So I think, yeah, as programmers, that level of audience engagement is really, really vital. You know, that's what it's the engaged audiences that we really want to develop, those who do challenge you, who do want to have that conversation, who want to stay behind and talk with the artist or talk with you about the work.
Who care.
Yeah, exactly. Even if that caring is just signing up to a mailing list sometimes, you know, that's enough care. But I think, allowing those spaces, allowing the audience agency in those spaces of discussion is as important as allowing them agency in the creation of work. You know, I think those sort of work in progress scratch engagements need to be very carefully held, framed, because I think, you know, the artist doesn't want to know if something should be painted blue or somebody should be funnier or, you know, why is that person called John and not Phil? They want to know how people feel in those spaces and, you know, and often compare that to how they wanted people to feel. And I think often that isn't held that well.
But then
it can be, obviously.
But if it is, and then like linking it back to what you were saying about people as critics and people being able to talk about what they think about work.
Yeah.
I feel like those work in development showings are such a brilliant way to allow audience members to do that.
Yes, they are, but they're also often commenting on something that's not finished. My grandma always used the phrase, never show an idiot never show a fool or a child anything half done. not that I'm saying an audience is a fool or a child, but I think you have to be very careful. Sometimes it's better to finish it. You know, it's better to make the complete shiny finished piece of work, and then people are responding to something which has had everything put into it that you want to put into it. Sometimes, obviously, you want to show something because you're not sure if you're going in the right direction or whether this has got any legs at all, in which case, great. You know, that obviously is really important. But I think it's always, again, as a commissioner or as a programmer, as a whatever, it's ensuring that you're creating the right opportunities for the artist who's making that particular work at that particular time. If they want to do work in progress, great. If you've got an audience who wants to engage with that, great. But if the artist doesn't want to do work in progress, so, you know, there's plenty of people who really reject the idea of scratch. And And there is this, I really like Ian's programme with Bradford because he only does Works in Progress. Yeah. I think that's a very strong political act. And, you know, it makes absolute sense in that context. If you're somewhere where, you know, at Warwick, we would often do a Work in Progress and then they have the complete piece of work. I'm not sure whether that does develop audiences because some people come to the Work in Progress and go, well, I've seen it.
Seen it.
Or they come back and go, well,
it's the same.
It's the same, or it's a lot better.
Thank God.
Thank God. The first version looked awful. So, whether they're an audience development tool, I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting one about developing people as critics because I think you would have to really reduce the number of people who were experiencing a work in progress to allow them that opportunity because it then becomes much more like Maddie Costa being in the room with Chris Good, for instance.
Yeah.
Because then, I mean, I know she performs a very different function. It's not just about criticism. But
there comes a point where you're no longer accessing it as an audience. You're accessing it as a creator or participant.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is different.
And I think, audience agency is really important when an artist wants or needs it. It's not something that we can foist on people. You know, some people will always want that. And it's part of their practice and their process. And for some people, they don't even really want to talk to the audience afterwards. But but actually, the experience at the moment of connection can be as powerful or has the quality that we would want from that experience. In either case, actually, I think we all do this. Actually, we say, you know, this is the way it should be now. You know, let's tear down the buildings. Let's not build any more theatres. Let's only do it outdoors. Let's
kill all the gatekeepers. Let's burn down the palaces.
No more producers as artistic directors. Yeah,
so I'm a producer. I'm also a producer.
Take all the money away from opera and distribute it more evenly, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
There is an argument for all of those things, but I think we have to recognise the strength of the ecology, and actually the ecology needs large and small and indoor and outdoor and participatory and whatever the opposite of
and diversity in its real sense.
In its real sense, yeah, and that's art form and practice and everything, as well as all the other definitions of diversity. And I think, if we can recognise the strength of that ecosystem, I don't know whether you read it, the Warwick Commission, on the future of cultural value, which had some really interesting work in there on ecosystem. And I think we have to recognise that, obviously, you know, I hate the term grassroots for some reason. I don't know why I don't like the term grassroots, but, you know, work of different scale, working in communities, working in very different ways to the ways that buildings can, or, you know, even if they should work in that way, they often aren't equipped to work in that way. But we all need each other, actually. I think it's important for Leeds that there is an opera house.
So, right, I'm just going to ask this question, but then I'm going to wrangle us back to the actual point of the discussion, which we have strayed away from. But you just said we all need each other, and yeah, we do, right? But just more and more, I find myself thinking, and I'm just going to be on my hobby horse for a minute.
Yeah,
like, I feel like we all need each other, but the people that we actually need the most are the people that make the fucking art.
Yes.
And the people that are most exploited in the current system are the people that make the fucking art. And they're the people that are insecure, underpaid. You know, they have the worst wages, the worst job security, the least agency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's fucked up, right?
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. I think the systems which I'll say we, you know, from the position that I'm in, we have allowed to develop.
We the ecology.
Well, the ecology, but also those people in salaried positions, actually, have allowed to develop in terms of the economy around the payment of artists. And that isn't because, I think 90% of the time, that isn't because we undervalue artists or because we think they shouldn't be paid more, but that we haven't fought a system around the subsidy, the funding of the arts in this country. Mm. We haven't fought in the ways that we should have done for increased investment in the arts. You know, we had what we, you know, if you've been around long enough, what we referred to as the golden years under Blair, which was only getting back to sort of zero point after years and years of chronic underfunding. And then we've allowed it to be stripped back again over the last however many god-awful years it's been under Cameron. Six years. Only 6 years. Four more to go.
Or we could stage a bloody revolution tomorrow.
Stage a revolution.
I've got a pitchfork.
I've got a whole idea about that, but maybe not for a podcast. Maybe for a different podcast.
Okay.
One that was anonymous. I think we haven't fought for the funding which would allow us to pay people better. And we've allowed... Some organisations have become... bloated is a very loaded word.
Yeah.
But I think they are over-resourced, both in terms of...
Inefficient.
Operations. They're inefficient. That's a good way of putting it. And I think, you know, there are obviously examples where people are paid, you know, massive inflated salaries. But I think they're actually pretty few and far between. And they're in organisations which are making a huge amount of money.
Mm.
They're generally not the organisations who are paying artists badly. I mean, if you think of the Opera House, for example.
Oh, no, I love working there. I get paid so well.
No, exactly. And, you know, all the musicians get paid well, all the singers, all the technicians get paid really well. But there is that. I think... I don't know whether it's ever been any different.
Mm.
I mean, that's one thing to say. I mean, I think artists have always struggled.
But it's basic Marxism, right? Like, there was a point when the means of production was in the hand, like, who that was in the hands of.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, you made the thing, you flogged the thing, in really simplistic terms. Mm-hmm. And now you don't. You make the thing. You go to someone and you ask them if you can possibly exhibit the thing in their shop window.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to stop because I hate myself for using this economic model to talk about art. But you get my point, right? Yeah. And there are all these middle people.
There are people skimming off the top.
Yeah, there are people skimming off the top. Richard from... Is it Farnham? The germs that grow on funding, you know, there are so many of those.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's true.
I may have been one for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tricky one because I wouldn't like to point the fingers at anybody in particular and say, I think they're a waste of space. Because
I don't know. There's some people I point the finger at. Just for devilment.
I would never, because just in case somebody fancied pointing a finger back again.
Yeah.
But I think generally speaking, in the ecosystem, everybody feels they're playing a part.
Mm.
You know, whether they are more or less effective is another question. But the crucial thing to change is that we are not paying artists properly. Mm. And I think there are plenty of organisations where they're only offering box office splits and putting all the risk with the artists when they could quite easily be paying some form of guarantee.
Yeah.
And I think I know artists have started doing this. I think if artists said no more often when they're offered a shitty deal, then venues would soon wake up because they wouldn't have any programme left. There is always somebody who's going to undercut, but hopefully people will start to realise.
Also, because I was a programmer until last week, right? Yeah. Yes. But, like, fuck that, no! Because the people giving the money, the programmers, they're funded by the goddamn government to do this shit.
Mm-hmm.
They are the people that should be setting the bar for what is right.
Yeah.
And acceptable. You can't expect the totally disempowered, non-agency holding
I'm not saying that I expect artists to change everything.
I don't know why I'm yelling at you about this.
I always
make guarantees. You're totally on my side. We agree on this, but I'm just yelling at
you. But I think if venues aren't going to change,
yeah,
and you know there are plenty of examples that, I mean, plenty of people listening to this will know exactly who I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
But there are lots of people who should just be told no. You need to pay guarantees.
Yeah.
Now, the Arts Council could do that. Mm. You know, the Arts Council could start to impose that. But then actually they're stuck within the same sort of system. Well, not the same sort of system. They're playing within the same economic system as we're talking about, where if the Arts Council has reduced the funding for an organisation by 20% over the last 6 years, or, you know, whatever it has been in real terms, or... in real terms, then they can't then turn around to a venue and saying rather than saving the costs on artists, you're going to have to, well, they could, I suppose.
They could say,
you need to pay guarantees, you're going to have to look at where you're going to raise the rest of the money from. But then they have been doing that with things like Catalyst Evolve, and that's pushing us more towards an American funding system, which is reliant on private cash, which is largely non-existent outside London.
Mm.
So... we're bound up with things that we can't necessarily, we can't all change all of these things. But I think if Bryony's done this, Scotty's done this, making it really transparent or really unavoidably obvious to venues that those practices can't continue, while at the same time recognising that it's not us and them, actually, and that... it's about a joined up conversation. Yeah, I was quite frustrated at the time when the I'll show you mine thing came out. That venues weren't invited into those discussions. In fact, I hosted two
of them.
Yeah,
and venues were invited and people didn't come. I was at a venue, I was running a venue and I hosted one.
Yeah.
And one other venue, maybe two came.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was in those conversations at Devoted and Disgruntled and was getting clubbed to death by artists who were earning 10 grand more than me a year. And I was
It's not... anyway, I think this is all beside the point in a way, because I think artists should be paid properly. And I think we all agree on that.
Good.
But how we get to that point, you know, this might be one of the revolutions that we're talking about. Yeah. I think there also has to be recognition that there are probably more artists making more work than at any point in history.
And maybe more than we need.
And perhaps more than we need. I mean, I think we haven't reached a point of natural selection in terms of work. Mm. And I think that's a really hard thing, because again, you know, there is a desire on all of our parts to be inclusive and to give opportunities to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
But that's not possible.
And the first thing to go should be the stuff that isn't that great. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although
who decides that? I don't know.
Yeah. And
apart from me. Because I should be God.
Apart from a series of demigods with gogs with really good taste.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's always going to be a problem, isn't it, really?
Mm.
I don't know. You know, there will always be bad work and there will always be good work. And there will always be subjectivity in art where some people think the good stuff's awful and some people think the awful stuff's
good.
Great. My legacy would be we all made the right decisions all the time.
Yeah, so this is so good. You went back, because that was what... Because we've been rambling on for like an hour. And so I was just going to say, what do you want your legacy to be? Like, and you can choose that to be in this role, or you can choose that to be when you die. Or at any point between here and then.
Oh, God. If by legacy we sort of meant something I might be remembered for, no, that's something different.
I mean, I would say that in my world, the definition of legacy is the thing that you leave behind you.
Yeah.
The thing you leave changed.
Yeah. I yeah, it would be brilliant to sort of leave behind a system that, or a system that was changed to be more accommodating of risk and challenge, and a system that created, or a structure that had been created that better supports artists to give them space, time, money, resources to make really exciting work. I think not only because we're sitting here, but I think the resource that Alan and Slung Lo give to artists here is really fantastic. I think if we can together, if I could leave behind a structure that created a greater sense of permeability in some of those big organisations, so the big stages were really accessible to artists, because, you know, again, that's something we haven't seen in this country for a while. That shifting from small scale to middle scale is although it's scale, what does that mean? But it's basically people making for large work for larger stages, and those larger stages aren't accessible because.
Unless
you're Simon McBurney. Simon McBurney, but he's been around a bit now, hasn't he?
Yeah, a wee while.
But just thinking about the producing house that I always refer back to at Campo in Ghent.
Mm.
They've got two beautiful theatres. The stage in both of them is about 14 by 14 meters, about 6-7 meters of height. Auditorium's only about 150, 200, something like that.
Lovely.
So it's just a perfect relationship between audience and stage. The stage allows that space for people to make work, which is visually, I don't know.
Arresting.
Arresting, challenging, fills your peripherals, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we haven't got those spaces in this country. You know, there are very few stages that large with manageable auditoria, if you like. Mm. And, you know, if you look at the resourcing of Campo, they get, I can't remember what they get, something like £1.5, £2 million a year, a euro equivalent, to put on a programme which is, you know, far smaller than an organisation with similar funding in this country. And those organisations would have 1,500, 2,000 seats. So sort of subsidy per seat is just enormous.
Yeah.
And I think, again, though, if we could change that in this country, if we could actually suddenly create a paradigm shift where people suddenly go, no, we do need to pay for culture in this country.
Does it come down to a qualitative rather than quantitative analysis? Does it come down to saying, this thing is good, let's just, like, maybe if instead of encouraging arts organisations to be entrepreneurial, we went, do you know what, fuck it, here's the money, offer everything for free. Do you think that would do something?
Yes, I haven't costed that. I don't know, because, you know, there is something also about the audience valuing the art as well, I think.
But do they have to value it in economic terms? Because they give their time. Like, it's a reciprocal contract, audience and performer, right? They turn up and they give their hour or their 2 hours, and
you could take money out of economics altogether.
Let's do that.
That would make life so much easier or more complicated. But I think while you've still got a system where people are paying for things, obviously you want to, there should always be access points and ways for people to engage with work that they aren't necessarily paying for. But if somebody has spent 50 grand making a show, why shouldn't somebody pay £15 a ticket to see that show? Or whatever the, however you want to break it down. You know, I think if people in this country actually realised how much they would be paying without any subsidy, I think that would be quite interesting, at least for them to understand that better. If you go over to the States, you know, as some of us are fortunate to do every now and then. I went to see Sarah Jones do a work in progress at New York Live Arts in January. So Sarah Jones did a piece called "The Revolution Will Not Be Happen Between These Thighs." People remember that. Brilliant performer, amazing performer. Work in progress, capacity. She did 5 nights of work in progress in a theatre which was 250, 300 capacity, sold out for the week. They charged $75 a ticket for that, and that was a one-woman show. And people were very happy to pay that money because I think in the States they know that there is no substitute in it. In that system.
Yeah, but then you look at their audiences as someone who's just had 3 shows there in the last 12 months, like...
Yeah. They're not working class audiences.
They're not working class audiences. They're not in any way diverse audiences. They're really lovely, thoughtful, committed, engaged, entitled audiences. Mm-hmm. But if you want, you know, we very much think about art with an instrumentalist tinge in this country, and you cannot do that without subsidy.
Yeah. Although it's a really interesting one, though, isn't it? Because, you know, how much difference is there really between Frankie Boyle doing stand-up and Chris Thorpe doing a one-man show? Obviously, Frankie Boyle's a lot funnier. Just saying that.
I don't know. Chris makes me laugh. Chris makes me laugh while quaking in my boots.
No, that was just a friendly jibe. But people are very happy to pay £30 a ticket to go and see Frankie Boyle.
Yeah.
And Frankie's and his management are taking 80% of that.
Do you think then we just...
And he's selling, 1,500 tickets a night.
Do you think we just don't guarantee enough of a good time?
It's about what a good time means, and if we can create a legacy in which people feel they are being fed, nourished by a much wider range of experience, you know, whether that is laughing or crying or having their brains melted, then I think we will have really achieved something. And, you know, we are tying ourselves up in knots, I think, particularly in theatre, in ways that people don't do in contemporary art, for instance, or contemporary visual art. They just make the thing. And that is because it's a very different economic system. You know, it's essentially based on patronage or on a gallery system where people make a piece and a gallerist says, I can sell that for X amount of money, and then if somebody pays that much, they say, well, I'll stick another 20% on next time, and you get that growth, or you get a Saatchi turning up and saying, I'm going to buy all of this artist's work forever. And, you know, I think there is a risk in that. There is a fetishization of the object, obviously, in contemporary art. And I have, you know, in the past played with that idea of, you know, fetishizing the transient. How do we create an experiential economy where people say that experience is never going to exist again, it's worth X amount of money. But then that's...
But we do it with food.
We do it with food,
I mean, the
yeah.
fat duck.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And that is, you know, the fat duck is a very interesting one when they've got something like, 50 covers and they've got 50 chefs.
It's a fringe theatre.
Yeah. But with 50 one-to-one experiences, essentially. And
it's the equivalent of, do you remember BAC's one-to-one fest?
Yeah.
It's like paying £120 for that.
Yeah. Which, you know, why shouldn't people do that?
Well, why should... look, why shouldn't people, if we accept that most people then won't be able to experience it? Do we care about that?
Well, yes, we do. But then we get back into the question of subsidy. You know, if we have a properly subsidised system, then we should be able to pay artists as if they were the venue were receiving a ticket price of £120 a person, even if we were only charging £10 to the end user.
And actually, we don't say that all kinds of people should be able to go and eat at the Fat Duck, do we? So what's the difference?
Well, because there's no subsidy in the system. There's no subsidy in restaurants, which allows, you know, if we reimagined a cultural ecology where food as art was part of that ecology, and therefore world class restaurants were subsidized to the same level as the opera house.
So happy,
yes. Man. For those of us who like our food,
I'd be so happy and so fat.
I'd be so much richer. I think that's a utopian ideal, isn't it? Really, or it's a different ideal, because you know that you could say the equivalent of our DIY theatrical culture is those of us who really love cooking and inviting friends around to have dinner, and we give those things away for free. Or you do pay what you can supper club.
Yeah.
You know, there is that extreme, and the Fat Duck is the Royal Opera House, really. McDonald's is going to the cinema, or you know, whatever that. Or,
I feel that's really unfair on the cinema.
Well, yes, that is unfair on the cinema. I was trying to think of a funnier equivalent to McDonald's in our sort of food theatre analogy, but I didn't want to tar anybody with that brush, because I don't think anybody's quite sunk that low yet. But I think it's all about subsidy, though. I think we can all try and find different ways of funding our work. We can crowdsource. We can do trust and foundations. We can look for sponsorship. Mm. We can rinse our ticket income as far as possible. But it all comes down to those. Yeah, that economy doesn't add up without public support, public funding for the arts. What we haven't done as a sector is communicate the value of that subsidy to an audience, or to a non-audience, more importantly, actually, to an electorate.
Mm.
So that we don't have these daft conversations about the value of public subsidy, because whenever you see a below the line discussion about that, the sort of trolls come out thick and fast to decry any form of public funding and the way it poisons the arts. Which, you know, if you look at it in some ways, you could make that argument. But I think we've always had forms of investment in the arts which haven't been clean. You know, there's been patronage, whether it's church or state, or a Borgia or a Medici. And we're lucky enough now to have a degree of arm's length. How arm's length it is anymore, I'm not sure, but you know, I think we have the principle of arm's length funding in this country, and I think that's something we should be hugely proud of and support with all our will and might. So if I were to have a legacy, it would be that we grow that public support and public funding. You know, we have more support for the arts and their value and their impact, or understanding of their impact, even if people aren't engaging with it, actually, even if they're not coming to the theatre, just accept and value the fact that it exists, and see where that value and impact comes in those things that people are consuming, that the culture that people are consuming otherwise. And you know, ensuring that artists are paid properly, you know, really making sure that we have a system where there is, you know, no sense of us and them, that people are paid properly to do a proper job, and that artists make really fantastic work as a result.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.